Welcome to the Investor Download, the podcast about the themes driving markets and the economy now and in the future. I'm your host, David Brett. Today we're broadcasting an episode from our friends at the Value Perspective podcast. Our colleagues Juan Torres Rodriguez and Andrew Lydon speak to former New York Times journalist Matthew Wald. We'll link to the full podcast in the show notes. For four decades, Matthew covered the energy sector, among many other beats, for the New York Times. He also worked for the Nuclear Energy Institute. He's now an analyst at the Breakthrough Institute, which is a non-governmental organisation based in Berkeley, California, concerned with climate and energy and agriculture. What follows is a discussion a bit longer than usual on why renewable energy may not be the solution to our energy security needs and where and how nuclear energy fits into the energy supply network. But first, we'll take a step back and ask where it all went wrong for nuclear energy previously. You'll hear first from Matthew, then from Juan, and finally from Andrew. Enjoy.
In the United States, it got it wrong. In Asia, it did not get it wrong. But there's a series of events in the United States that made life more difficult for nuclear. The most recent one is improvement in drilling technology. We turn out to have massive amounts of methane fuel, natural gas, fossil gas, that we didn't know we had, we didn't know were accessible, and the price crashed, and that brought down the price of electricity with it, and in that environment, nobody wants to build nuclear. Before that, we never really standardized our nuclear products. Each reactor was built slightly differently. So they do have common components, but you can't simply move operators from one to another. You can't simply use the plans from one to build another. And the lack of standardization left us with a variety of plants, all of which are highly optimized. They run very well. They run very reliably, but they're hard to duplicate. In addition, we ceased doing a lot of research and development on new reactor technologies. The United States uses entirely now light water reactors, and that's patterned on what the U.S. Navy did. Light water reactors are perfect for submarines, but on land, there are other options that we should have been trying out and we're now racing to perfect. Europe used a somewhat wider variety of reactors. Great Britain uses some gas graphite reactors, a direction we're now going in. But we've had a gap in construction, which is difficult to recover from. We don't have the skilled workforce. We don't have the techniques in place. And we had a gap in research and design work, but we're now working to cure those gaps. We also are in a situation in the United States where electricity growth has been very slow. Demand growth has been very slow. And there has not been a real reason to build anything new. So we are putting in wind and solar, which have an advantage. They reduce the fossil fuel burn. They're not much for meeting peak capacity, but during many hours of the day, they reduce the amount of coal and fossil gas you have to burn. But we have not just had a lot of call for building new generation of any type.
It feels to us, though, that interest and awareness are picking up. Do you think this is true? And if so, what needs to happen for it to pick up?
Well, it's picking up for several reasons. One is concern over climate. We have odd, weird climate at the moment. California had a tropical storm. Where I live, we've had smoke from Canadian wildfires coming down into large parts of the United States. We've had droughts, we've had floods, and people are generally more concerned about this. People are also more concerned, especially after the war in Ukraine, about energy security. And it's easier to maintain energy security with reactors than it is with fossil plants that require large volumes of fossil fuel to be shipped in, often from very distant places. And I believe that for those reasons, we have returned to intense research and development, and we will return to large-scale construction. In the United States, this is a real challenge. if we're going to get to 100% fossil-free, carbon-free energy, we need to retire about 60% of our generating system. And if we're going to convert all of the cars and trucks to electricity, all of the industrial use of natural gas to electricity, all of the heating to electricity by mid-century, we're going to have to multiply our supply of electricity by a factor of 2.5 to 3. So throw out 60% of what you've got and multiply it by a factor of 2.5 to 3. We need roughly 10 times as much non-emitting electric generation as we have today by mid-century. That's a very tall order. We can get some of it from wind and solar, which can be easier to install, but we need to get a lot of it from nuclear.
I would have thought that one of the reasons where some countries had gotten this wrong had a little bit of responsibility on dogmatic views by environmental people trying to impose an agenda in the 1980s or even the 1970s, but you didn't make an allusion to them.
Well, it's true. In the United States, we regulate nuclear energy to a much, much stricter standard than fossil energy. We know fossil fuels kill people in obvious ways. We have explosions now and again. In not so obvious ways, we have elevated death rates because of air pollution. We know nuclear power doesn't do that. The risk that we will tolerate from a reactor is a lot smaller than the risk we will tolerate from other forms of energy generation. And this has put a burden on the nuclear industry. Now, the established utilities won't complain about this. They've learned to live with it. But it is a problem if you go out to build something new.
This is a question that we've asked other guests in the past, but we're interested in your opinion. What is, in your opinion, the biggest misconception about nuclear power today?
It's that it somehow has a bigger environmental footprint than other forms of energy. It doesn't. It has a smaller environmental footprint. We don't have to take bulldozers into the desert and level vast areas to build solar farms. We don't have to build enormous new transmission systems to handle intermittent energy from really distant places. The trouble with wind and solar is you have to build them where the wind and solar is. Nuclear fuel you can ship anywhere. You can't put a reactor just anywhere, but there are lots of places to put a nuclear reactor. We don't have to build enormous wind farms that make life difficult for other people in the neighborhood. The fuel requirements can be met in an environmentally mostly benign way, certainly more benign than coal mining or gas drilling or oil drilling. All in all, it's an environmentally friendly technology, but it isn't always seen that way. I would love to live near a nuclear plant. For one thing, they pay lots of taxes. It keeps your local property taxes down. They don't pose a risk to their neighbors, or at least not as large a risk as coal and gas do. And they're more pleasant to live near than a wind farm. Also, at the moment, we have a backlash here in the United States, it may be true in Europe also, against massive renewable development. Offshore wind we will probably tolerate, but it has environmental problems and it has aesthetic problems and construction problems. Onshore wind and solar face big challenges in siting, in getting permission from local authorities to build them, as opposed to all of the places for which new reactors have been proposed, people welcome them.
Yeah, just to build on that environmental impact point, or the misjudgment of the environmental impact point that you made, like one issue that people would often point to would be the impact of storing nuclear waste or the treatment of nuclear waste and the long-term environmental implications of that. Could you just say a little bit about the facts around those?
There is no impact from storing spent fuel. In an area the size of a basketball court or a tennis court, you can store decades of fuel. We've gotten very good at packaging this stuff. I've seen it done. You put it in a cask, you dry out the cask, you pump the cask full of inert gas so that there's no corrosion. you move it out to a small concrete silo out in the open. It's passive. It doesn't have any moving parts. You would know it's nuclear waste from a distance if it's in a location that sometimes gets snow in winter, because it's slightly warm. Snow won't stick to it. That's about it. These things have holes at the bottom in the concrete surrounding silo and holes at the top. So there's a passive airflow. There's a chimney effect that keeps it cool. And you got to send somebody out there every few weeks to see that no small animals have built nests next to the metal interior, which would block the airflow. They're guarded, but they're really very secure. One of our problems is we're babysitting these things here in the United States at scores of different locations. It would make more sense to centralize them. As time goes by, their heat production declines. As their heat production declines, they get easier to bury. If you look at places where we want to bury nuclear waste, the controlling factor is heat production, because you don't want to boil the groundwater. If you boil the groundwater, you get steam. Whatever chemical reactions are going to occur will occur faster with steam with a hot repository than a cool repository. So to a certain extent, there's an advantage in delay, although I think everybody would be happier if we found a place to bury this stuff or bury many of the components of this stuff. I think a lot of it may be chemically reprocessed and recovered for reuse. The Finns and the Swedes are going to demonstrate that it's technically possible and that it is actually in the United States. The difficulty is an artifact of our governmental structure, which is the federal government can pick someplace, the locals can like it, and the states do not. But eventually we'll overcome that problem. And in the interim, we'll just babysit the stuff. This is different from coal waste or waste from burning natural gas, which you and I are breathing. We know where that waste is. It's in the atmosphere. I'd rather have it bottled up in a secure container.
How do other countries manage the issue of waste? France has a very big installed capacity on nuclear. Canada has been quite successful. The Chinese are building a lot of nuclear. So how do they go about this?
It differs. The French, let me go back a step. When you run a nuclear reactor on uranium, you produce a little bit of plutonium. The plutonium is a very good reactor fuel. It's not a good weapons fuel, and the reason is it's a mix of isotopes, and for a weapon, you want pure isotopes. In a light water reactor of the kind we operate here in the United States, after the fuel's been in place for a few months, you're fissioning not only uranium, but also some plutonium. But then when you're done, you take the fuel out, and the fuel is like a battery in a flashlight. Its form has not changed. From the outside, it doesn't look any different. And we package it and store it in a spent fuel pool to cool, and then store it out on an open pad somewhere. The French take this material, chop it up mechanically, and dissolve it in acid and sort the components chemically. And they recover the plutonium, and they use the plutonium as fuel. The remainder has a smaller volume, and to some extent, it won't be radioactive for as long. There are still some long-lived components, but one of the long-lived components, the plutonium, has been removed. The Russians are very good at this. The Russians, although they have a mixed civilian and military system, but they've been reprocessing for years. The United States did this early on, but now has what's called a once-through cycle, which is we use the uranium, we use a little of plutonium, but we don't touch the used fuel. In the United States, the law concerning a repository, a burial site, specifies that the fuel must be retrievable for the first few decades. So if you change your mind later, you can take it out of the ground, chop it up, and recover the valuable components. And then the other side is, the French also, after you've chopped this stuff up and removed what you want, they pour the rest into a strong form of glass that blocks radiation. So the final waste form they have to dispose of is a solid, not a liquid. And you're better off with a solid because it won't dissolve and move around on you. We understand all those technologies and we have practiced them to a limited extent, but we don't do them routinely. At some point, we probably will do them routinely. And on the other end, there are the Swedes and the Finns who are just building granite repositories. Granite is very stable. You can find granite structures that have been there for millions of years, and they will bury it in granite. And eventually we will do the same either with fuel that came out of a reactor or fuel that came out of a reactor had useful materials removed from it, and then the remainder was solidified and buried.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, you're listening to the Investor Download.
You've been covering the issue of nuclear waste for the last 40 years. Has the problem from a perception point of view and execution been the same, or the fear around it has changed but has just remained?
The people who don't like nuclear energy, the first thing they will say is, well, what about the waste? But I don't think their objection is actually to waste. I think they're afraid of accident, and that is just not a rational fear, especially compared to the alternatives, especially compared to oil and gas and coal. I think a lot of people have just accepted the idea that this is a problem we're not going to solve in the immediate future, and we will manage the stuff securely until we figure out how to handle it.
Really interesting. Something that you've been writing quite a bit about, and correct me if I'm wrong if that's not the case, but it's this concept that was developed by Lazard, the investment bank, about levelized cost of electricity, LCOE. Yeah. So could you please explain to our listeners what exactly is that and why it's so important to account for it on the entire climate change debate?
Yes. I'm not certain that Lazard invented levelized cost of electricity, but they certainly are the leading practitioner. And they have recently walked back from that. They have changed their minds a little bit. They have cautioned people about how the metric should be used. I'd almost say they've repented. And levelized cost of electricity means it costs me this amount to build the plant. Over its lifetime, it will produce X amount of electricity. The operating cost is Y amount. Let's get out a pocket calculator, figure total cost, total production, and what is the cost per kilowatt hour, which is very useful, but it embeds a concept that is so basic nobody ever thought about it much, which is you're only going to run the plant when you need it. So if you're going to build a coal plant or a natural gas plant, you are going to run it when the system needs the electricity and when the production has value. If you go to solar, there is no operating cost, basically. You're going to run it whenever the sun is available. You're going to run the wind turbines whenever the wind is available. Sometimes that production will enter into the market and be worth a great deal. Sometimes, especially with solar, there'll be so much of it out there that the solar alone, solar is fratricidal. Solar is cannibalistic. There'll be so much solar out there that it will drive the price down to zero or even below zero. So it doesn't matter if it's cheap to put up a solar panel and get electricity out of it. What matters is what is the ratio of the cost to the value? And if the value is zero or less than zero, and we have episodes in the United States of times when the value is less than zero, it doesn't matter what it costs you. It doesn't matter what the LCOE is. A nuclear plant, the ones we have today, want to run 24/7 for 92-93% of the hours in a year. It will produce electricity when there's a lot of solar out there and there's not much demand for the electricity or the price is very low. It will produce electricity when there's no renewable energy out there, when there's very high demand, which happens typically around sunset and a little after, and when prices are very high. its value will be averaged out over all the market conditions, market prices, all the hours of the year. So if you look at LCOE, yes, the cheapest way to get a kilowatt hour at this point in many locations might be solar, but so what? These are not, it's not like you're growing potatoes you can store. There's just no use for this stuff. You're going to either unplug the panel or waste the electricity somewhere because you don't have anything to use it for. Therefore, although the price of electricity coming out of a reactor may be higher, the reactor will still have higher value than a solar panel. Now, this is a system integration problem, and it will depend on how much solar is on the system. It will depend on what value you put on reliability, on having electricity 24/7. If you were running a ranch, a cattle ranch, and your only use for the electricity was to run a well and pump water into a trough so that the cattle could drink, and the water would sit there for hours or days, you don't care what time it's sunny. All you care about is getting enough kilowatt hours to do that work. If you and I are having a conversation over the internet, we really don't want to arrange the conversation when there's solar production at my end and at your end. We want to have a 24/7 system. So LCOE still has some value as a metric, but because of technological changes, you have to think twice about all of the metrics you need to use when choosing the components of an integrated electric system.
It looks as though the renewable capacity is going to continue to grow. So do you have any thoughts on how big that portion of the overall generation mix could be before we start to get into trouble? Is there a kind of natural place where it can sit and not be too problematic, or how can those things balance out?
Luckily, we're running a real world experiment. It's called California. And in California, there's a law that if you build a new house, it has to have solar on the roof. There are lots of incentives to build solar. And so they've got now a reverse of the ordinary price pattern. They've got dirt cheap electricity in the middle of the day and high prices in the evening. They also have a problem, which is if the state is oriented, if the geography is oriented from north to south, then the sun goes down on the grid at the same time. All over the grid. What you need is a grid that ran east to west thousands of miles, but we don't have that. I don't think any place has that. So they end up in a situation at sunset when all the solar goes away at the same time. All of the fossil plants have been turned down during the day to make space for the solar on the grid, and then they have to start up again. But fossil electric plants are not like automobiles that can go from 0 to 60 miles an hour in 5 seconds. They are more like trains, which will start up when they leave a station, but not achieve maximum speed for some time after that. In fact, they end up at sunset with a rise in electric demand faster than they can meet. The solar is going away faster than the other systems can get started. So California has mandated batteries. People think, oh, batteries, it's so we can get solar power to use at night. Well, sort of. Its real function is to help California get over the evening challenge every day, something to tide the system over until the natural gas plants can get started. So California is reaching the point where the marginal new solar panel is useless. They are going to demonstrate for the rest of the world how much they can assimilate. And technology will help them and things will change as time goes on. Batteries may get better and cheaper. At the moment, they're not very good and they're very expensive. They may find some ways to shift some demand into the middle of the day instead of the evening or other peak times when there's no solar. One technique, which I find is very interesting, is if you're at work all day, you're going to come home from your office at 5 p.m., 6 p.m. You're going to get home and start up the microwave, start up the TV set, turn up the air conditioning because it's been turned down all day. California is suggesting as one strategy, you set the thermostat on your air conditioning to get really cold in the house, 65 degrees, 60 degrees, when there's too much electricity on the grid at noon. Noon is peak production hour. That's the definition of noon. And when you get home, you turn the electricity, the air conditioning off. But the walls are cold, the floors are cold, the furniture is cold. You don't need air conditioning for a little while. The whole house is a thermal battery. That's one possibility. I find really interesting, I find really interesting the natrium reactor that is planned for Wyoming. This is built by GE and by a company backed by Bill Gates. This reactor turns out a steady level of electricity, but that doesn't get turned, steady level of heat, but that does not go straight to electricity. It heats up a large tank of salt, and the salt gets hotter and hotter over the course of the day. On the other side of the tank is a steam generator system. There are pipes running through the salt. You pump water through them, and the water boils into steam. So you have a thermal battery. So you might have the plant producing 100 megawatts at noon when there's lots of solar, and 500 megawatts right after sunset when there's no solar and everybody quickly needs electricity. It is a reactor that's designed to rescue the grid from too much solar. And that kind of development, now that's a battery, not like the kind you put in a flashlight. It doesn't have a positive and a negative terminal. It's just a big tank of heat, but heat is a form of storage. So the exact amount of solar or wind that a system can tolerate isn't clear. The dominant form of storage right now is pumped hydro. In other words, when you've got too much electricity, you pump water up to the top of the hill. When you need it, you let it run back down through a hydroelectric plant. That has some drawbacks. First of all, its round-trip efficiency is only about 66%, meaning you've got to put in 3 kilowatt hours to get 2 kilowatt hours back out. Second of all, the upper reservoir and the lower reservoir are both sterile because fish and aquatic life don't like big changes in the level of the water. But you can do it. If we discover, develop, make economic other storage technologies, then the amount of renewable sources, intermittent renewable sources that you can sensibly use will rise. But we're not going to get to zero, and we're not going to make enormous cuts in carbon dioxide output unless we have sources that we can dispatch. We can tell them when to run. You can tell a reactor when to run, especially the modern reactors now under development. You can't tell wind and solar when to run.
Get in touch with us by email at schroederspodcasts@schroeders.com or visit our website, schroeders.com/investor download.
Just to come on to one of the other kind of criticisms or skepticisms, area of skepticism about nuclear, but perhaps just be not a particularly dogmatic one, just a practical one in terms of the time and cost of installing new capacity. So we'll maybe talk about Vogtle 3 specifically in a right. in a set, but just looking, and maybe it's a bad example, but just looking at the time to build and the cost to build of that, even if you took a very pro-nuclear view, is it the case that you have to resign yourself to this being the answer, but not one that we can see the benefits of for 5, 10 years' right. time?
Well, Vogtle took a lot longer and cost a lot more than it was supposed to. Unit 4, Vogtle was a two-unit reactor plant built in the 80s. Units 3 and 4, Unit 3 just entered commercial operation. Unit 4, they just started loading fuel. These are Westinghouse AP1000 reactors. This was a design done by Westinghouse in the 90s that did two things. It was designed with a much simpler, more robust emergency system with less wiring, fewer valves, fewer pumps, less requirement for energy after an accident, just all around better thought through. And believe it or not, it was designed for constructability. The idea was you'd build major components offsite, plunk them in place, and put them together. The first example in the United States did not go well. partly because the company building the modularized components was not accustomed to nuclear work and could not deliver the modules on schedule and with the appropriate level of quality checks. But it may not be the technology. The Chinese built four of these things, two twin unit plants. They did a much faster job. They did much better at it. Now, they have a different economic system. Among other issues, their labor is a lot cheaper. But we could probably learn something from the way they did it. The Koreans built a Korean model reactor in the Persian Gulf that's based on a Westinghouse design. And they did that more or less on schedule and more or less on budget. And they're now talking about, they built four of them. They're talking about building two more in the United Arab Emirates. It can be done. It requires management expertise and a manufacturing supply chain that has atrophied, but we can bring it back. But it's true, you can put in a solar panel and get a kilowatt of electricity out of it faster than you can put in a kilowatt of nuclear, because you don't put in a kilowatt of nuclear. You put in many megawatts of nuclear. But we're going to need both. We're going to do both. And you simply cannot decarbonize the system on the basis of wind and solar. They can help. They could be a good bridge technology. They could minimize our fuel burn as we get more advanced nuclear online. But no, you can't do the whole system that way. In addition, the industry has turned after the Vogtle plants to smaller plants which are designed for constructability. And the theory is probably correct that we can stamp out components in a more assembly line fashion. Also, Vogtle is a pressurized water reactor. It has an operating pressure in the neighborhood of 2,200 pounds per square inch. So we're talking about hunks of steel that are 8 or 10 inches thick. Some of the advanced reactors run at near atmospheric pressure because they're not using water. They're using molten metal or molten salt as a coolant. They're using inert gas as a coolant. They produce higher temperatures, which does two things for you. It gives you higher thermal efficiency. You can make more electricity per megawatt of nuclear heat, and it gives you the opportunity to use nuclear heat in industrial processes. Today's nuclear reactors don't run particularly hot. They're not as hot as some coal and natural gas plants. If you can raise the temperature of their output, which you can do if you're not using water as the coolant, you can use them to make chemicals, you can use them to make steel, you can use them in all kinds of roles where they will displace carbon-based fossil fuels. And if you're using them in a low-pressure system, the components are a lot easier to make, a lot faster to make, and to assemble.
So just to give us a little bit of context, if we take a couple of those more successful projects that you mentioned, maybe the ones in Korea or in the Middle East, obviously them being on time and to budget is brilliant. But could you just give us some context of what the, you know, roughly what the timeframes and roughly what the sums of money were involved? Because I guess even if it's to schedule, but that schedule is 10 years, that's a long time. So just to give a little bit of background on what we're dealing with.
Yes, if you get the supply chain in order and you get a cadre of skilled, specialized workers and a management system, you should certainly be able to do it in less than 10 years. It'll still take time. Maybe it'll take you 8 years. And you will use an amount of nuclear that is appropriate to your system, depending on what other resources you have available, which depends in part on geography. And you'll probably pay more for the nuclear per megawatt of capacity, but it'll be worth more. Remember, a well-run nuclear plant has a capacity factor of over 90%. Capacity factor meaning how many hours of the year is it running. A solar panel may have a capacity factor in my neighborhood of about 14%. Out in the desert, maybe 21 or 22%. Wind can get higher, but it's also intermittent. So the dollars per megawatt of capacity, like LCOE, they're not strictly comparable. You need to look at them in terms of not what's cheapest, but what does the system need?
And then in terms of the smaller modular reactors that you mentioned, again, still a nascent technology, but how far away do you think we are from them being installed, not just in kind of trial mode, but in kind of widespread rollout?
Well, Ontario Hydro thinks it's going to put up a GE Hitachi BWRX by the end of this decade. The BWR, the boiling water reactor, the X is a Roman numeral. It's their 10th version. Their previous versions got larger and larger and larger. This one is smaller and is designed for constructability. There are some other plans out there to get reactors up and running by 2030. And some of them may do it. Some of them will come close. If you look at first-of-a-kind construction projects in any field, none of them goes completely as you planned. Many of them are over budget, delayed. Railways, big buildings, etc. Nuclear is not going to be any different, but it may get to the point where you can stamp them out and make them run better.
So demographically, lots of people without electricity or access to good electricity in emerging markets, again, trading off perhaps with pressure from others to reduce the carbon intensity of them growing their power output. And on the other hand, perhaps concerns about nuclear technology proliferating in some parts of the world. So what role do you see nuclear power having in developing economies?
At the moment, the fastest growing source of energy, electricity in the world, is coal. Forget what you've heard about a blossoming of solar and wind. It's coal. The reason is it's cheap and it's fast. It's reliable. We need technologies that we can deploy in developing countries that have two forms of limited infrastructure. One form is you never want to have more than about 10% of your generating capacity in a single unit, because plants of any kind, coal, gas, whatever, will go offline, and you don't want that to cause a national blackout. So small reactors are a better fit for a lot of grids than big reactors. The other place where developing countries have to catch up is they don't have an extensive supply chain and human technical base. However, advanced reactors with good automation, good design, may be easier to ship in and assemble and build and operate than the kind we run today. Because they're smaller, because they're modular, they require less work at the site. The United States and Europe, people point out, well, you know, we're only a few percent of the world's carbon output. Nothing we do is going to make a difference. It ain't so. What we're going to do that makes a difference is we're going to invent the technologies that solve this problem. We're going to export the technologies that solve this problem. We're going to export the hardware and the human skill that's going to do this. And the demand for electricity is growing very rapidly, not in the developed world, but in the developing world. And that's where small reactors can make a big contribution.
Matt, we can't pass on the opportunity to ask you about your thoughts regarding the impact of the current European conflict on the nuclear industry at large. What are your thoughts almost 1 year and a half after the invasion of Ukraine?
There are two categories of impact. One is that in a place like Poland, which was reliant on Soviet and now Russian fossil fuels, they have a very strong desire to be independent. And one of the ways to be independent is to build reactors. The other is what's going on in Zaporizhia clearly is not what anybody wanted. It's a reactor in a war zone. But it turns out that reactors that were built to contain terrific pressures and amounts of heat are tough, and earthquakes and other problems, other natural challenges, are tough installations. and they are difficult to damage accidentally. You could damage them intentionally, but there's not a lot of reason to do that. If you think about Zaporizhia, if the Russians want to control Ukraine, they would love to own this nuclear plant. They may do a little damage to it, but they certainly don't want to wreck it. And they don't want to let loose radioactive material that would cause problems for them too. This isn't the first instance of reactors being caught in a war zone, and it probably won't be the last. But it's in an industrial society, there's all kinds of civil infrastructure that's vulnerable and could be hazardous. Reactors don't rank particularly high on that. There's concerns raised by anti-nuclear types about the security of spent fuel. If you have dry cask storage for spent fuel, what happens if somebody hits it with a rocket-propelled grenade? Well, the answer is the fuel is a solid. Even if you busted one open, you'd get a little puff of inert gas out of it, and then you'd have solid material that you might spread in the immediate area. This is not in the category of widespread death and destruction. It's not in the category of hitting an oil refinery or a chemical plant with a conventional munition. So I think on balance, the experience of Ukraine is a strong desire for energy independence by a lot of places and a cognizance that, yes, like anything else, nuclear infrastructure can be in the path of opposing armies.
Then you've mentioned in the past the risk concerning supply of uranium and the fact that the Russians control a big component of that. Do you have any thoughts to share on that?
Yes, they control the supply of some uranium. Mostly, they provide uranium processing. You take uranium ore, yellow cake, and you run it through a chemical process to mix it with fluorine gas. And in that form, uranium hexafluoride, you put it into a centrifuge to enrich it. And then you ship the enriched uranium to a fuel fabrication plant. The Russians have a terrific capacity in converting it to uranium hexafluoride and enriching it. They do mine some uranium, but the world's largest supplier is not Russia, it's a different former Soviet republic, Kazakhstan. And because Kazakhstan is a low-cost supplier, there are huge deposits elsewhere that nobody's really bothered with. Canada and Australia, for example, and even the United States, have lots of uranium that's available for a few dollars more per pound than we're paying for Kazakh yellow cake, Kazakh uranium ore. And there's more interest now in developing these alternative sources that are in more stable areas. The Kazakhs had been shipping through Leningrad. They have now done some shipments through Pakistan, which avoids Russia. But even so, there's more interest now in a diversity of supply. In addition, none of the technologies involved here is secret. Lots of people could build conversion plants and could build new capacity to enrich with centrifuges. There's a lot of work going on in laser isotope separation, which has never been commercialized, but may be partly as a result of this conflict. The problem is it requires investment. And once you get one of these plants built, you want to keep it running. It's not the kind of thing you start and stop. For technical industrial reasons, you want to keep it running. So you want to build without creating a surplus. If you create a surplus, you'll be operating at a loss for years. So the commercial interests are rather reluctant to go ahead and invest. What would happen if there were a regime change in Moscow, if the war ends, and if all that Russian capacity is suddenly back on the Western market? They want some guarantee that there will be a market for the product for which they're building expensive infrastructure to supply. So there's a commercial problem here. There's an inertia problem here, but there is not a resource problem or a technical problem.
That was the show. We very much hope you enjoyed it. You can subscribe to the Investor Download wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get in touch with us, it's schroederspodcast@schroeders.com. And you can find out much, much more at schroeders.com/insights. New shows drop every other Thursday at 5 p.m. UK time. In the meantime, keep safe and go well.
The value of investments and the income from them may go down as well as up, and investors may not get back the amounts originally invested. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. The information is not an offer, solicitation, or recommendation of any funds, services, or products, or to adopt any investment strategy.